Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Shloem. Coming right up, an in-depth conversation with our friend and climate expert, NASA oceanographer, and climate scientist Josh Willis. Josh just returned from a stint studying the glaciers and icebergs around Greenland as part of his ongoing study called OMG for Oceans Melting Greenland. Later on in the show, we'll hear a report from our nature and environmental correspondent, Cheryl Hosler, about the role of mentoring in environmental science and education. But first up, our conversation with Josh Willis. Josh is a climate scientist and oceanographer at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. In 2009, he was awarded a Presidential Early Career Award from then President Obama, and in 2011, the American Geophysical Union awarded him an Early Career Award for Ocean Sciences. He's the project scientist for the Jason 3 Ocean Level Mapping Satellite and the principal investigator for OMG, Oceans Melting Greenland. Josh joined us via Skype from his home in Southern California. Josh Willis, welcome once again to Blue Dot.
Dave, it's good to be back, man.
And you really are back. Can you tell us where you're back from?
Yeah, I just spent about 4 weeks in Greenland collecting data for my mission, Oceans Melting Greenland.
4 weeks in Greenland. It almost sounds like an album title.
Well, it felt epic, that's for sure.
Yeah. Well, we'll get into that in a minute, but let's start out at the beginning. Tell us about OMG. What is Oceans Melting Greenland?
Well, Oceans Melting Greenland is a five-year-long NASA mission that uses aircraft. It's an airborne mission to try and answer the question, how much are the oceans eating away at the ice in Greenland from the edges? We know that the ice is melting, the atmosphere is getting warmer, the planet's getting warmer. But it turns out it's not just the air that's melting Greenland. A lot of the glaciers run right off the land into the ocean, and they literally sit in the seawater. So as the ocean warms up, it melts away at the edges of the glaciers, and this can cause them to speed up, break off more ice more quickly, and retreat, all of which speeds up sea level rise. And that's what we're trying to study with OMG.
Yeah, that all sounds like from physics, acceleration, speeding up, slowing down, changing direction. Are things accelerating up there?
Well, yes. We know from earlier satellite data, this mission called GRACE, which was a pair of satellites that literally weighed the continent, the continents, including the Greenland ice sheet. We know that it's losing mass more and more quickly over time. The question we're trying to probe with OMG is why? And I think part of the answer lies in the ocean.
Let's go back a little bit. Tell us about how you first got started at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory as an oceanographer slash climate scientist.
Well, I come from the Scripps Institution of Oceanography. That's where I got my PhD so many years ago now. And I began my work on oceanography by looking at some satellite data, which measures how high the sea level is. And it turns out that in the oceans, if you have a bunch of warm water, it can actually cause sea level to stand higher than it would otherwise. The sea level is telling you all kinds of stuff about the ocean, like the currents, but it's also, and global sea level rise, but it's also telling you about where the heat is in the ocean. And so when I was getting my PhD, I started trying to answer the question, well, how much heat is going into the ocean? And what does that mean for sea level rise? And it turns out that the oceans absorb over 90% of the heat that's trapped by the greenhouse gases we've added. So the oceans are really where all the global warming is happening. And, of course, they're rising. But they're not just rising from this extra heat. They're also rising from melting ice in places like Greenland and Antarctica.
Why is Greenland especially important? Because as I recall, there's a lot of ice there.
That's right. There is enough ice in Greenland to raise sea levels by 25 feet worldwide.
Wow.
Which would be, you know, almost unthinkable. You know, many coastal cities around the globe would have to be evacuated with 25 feet of sea level rise. I mean, we can adapt to a certain amount of sea level rise, and we can adapt if it happens slowly. But 25 feet would be enormous.
Yeah, that's a catastrophe.
Now, we don't expect it to happen all at once, but the real issue is we don't know how fast Greenland's ice can disappear, because we've never watched it disappear before like this.
Can we go back to the beginning? What's the genesis of OMG? When did you first become interested in this particular problem? And what's the process of, you know, going through a proposal to get a mission like this, you know, approved and funded?
Well, it's a long, long process, almost as long as it takes to do the science, it seems like. We spent a couple of years writing the proposal for OMG. And my interest shifted as I started to study sea level rise, because, you know, we can measure that the oceans are rising. We can do this really accurately. But we really need to understand the cause, what's driving it, in order to predict it in the future. And Greenland is one of the things that's driving it the fastest. It's almost 1/6 of global sea level rise all by itself just today. And it has the potential to speed up really quickly. And a few years ago, NASA sent out this call for proposals. It was called an Earth Ventures proposal. And they asked scientists to write proposals that did a 5-year experiment using aircraft. And I ran around JPL and thought really hard about it for a long time. And we eventually landed on Greenland as a place to study. But of course, you know, one of the first things you have to do is figure out how to convince NASA to give you $30 million. no small task. At the time, I just actually started taking comedy classes at the Second City Improv School in Hollywood. I was sitting in an improv class one day, and I kind of realized that if I'm going to try and get this big a project done at NASA, I need people to remember it. OMG, that's really important. And eventually I landed upon Oceans Melting Greenland as a mission name, not just because it's kind of surprising, which, you know, Greenland melting is surprising. But also those three words, oceans melting Greenland, they encompass the basic science that we're doing. And so it seemed like a perfect fit. And I'm not going to say that it's just because of the name that we got selected, but it didn't hurt.
But it helped, yeah. And yeah. I think that, as I recall, I've seen people text OMG before. I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, I think the younger generation learns to say OMG before they can say mama and dad.
and what's amazing is how prescient they were about climate change, that, you know, they're texting OMG, you know, thinking to themselves, oceans melting Greenland.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, it's a name you're not going to forget, right? Hopefully. And I think, you know, the stuff that's happening in Greenland is something we don't want to forget either.
When did the mission first begin? When did you first start making measurements and starting on this journey?
Well, we sort of began in 2015. We were in a big hurry to get started. And we got permission to start collecting data in 2015. Which was really quick. A lot of the other missions took a full year or two before they really were ready to go out in the field and take their observations. But we collected ship data in 2015. We sent a ship out to measure the shape and depth of the sea floor in and out of a lot of these fjords that feed that house the glaciers. And that turns out to be a really important part of this problem, because the water in Greenland that's warm is actually not at the surface. It sits down a little deeper. And in order for it climb up on the continental shelf around Greenland and reach into the fjord and touch the glacier, there has to be a pathway, a sort of network of canyons. And so the ship was there to map out that network. And that was really our first year, was trying to just map out the unknown areas of the ocean around Greenland, of which there are a lot.
I'm thinking about this problem of this warm water being down at the bottom, and that seems counterintuitive. You would think that the cold water would be down there. How much of this has to do with the salinity of the water, that it's got more salt in it, so it's more dense, so it sinks, and how much of it has to do with the Atlantic conveyor, that the Gulf Stream, the water circulation pattern around the Atlantic Ocean? Is it just kind of a perfect combination of those things?
Well, yeah, absolutely. The saltiness of the water is kind of super important in the Atlantic, in the far north, and right around Greenland. And it's that saltiness that makes the warm water heavy. The reason it's sitting down deep is because it's heavy. And so this warm, salty water comes up out of the Atlantic, and it's covered with a sort of layer of colder, fresher water that comes out of the Arctic. And those two water masses, cold water on top of the warm water, are sort of, ubiquitous. They're everywhere around Greenland. They're all along the shelves and in and out of the fjords. Everywhere we look, we see this sort of two layers of water, this cold, fresh layer on top of a warm, salty layer. Now, the overturning circulation in the North Atlantic operates for the same reason. This is the so-called ocean conveyor belt. And the reason it happens is that the water in the North Atlantic is very salty. And so when the big winter storms blow over the far North Atlantic, they evaporate a lot of water, they make it a little bit saltier and a whole lot colder, and it sinks. It sinks really deep, sometimes all the way to the bottom of the ocean. And then from there, it slowly spreads out across the entire rest of the globe. And that's the overturning circulation. And so really, the saltiness of the water, if you're an oceanographer, is almost the most important thing if you're looking at the ocean, sort of north of the southern tip of Greenland.
If as what you're observing up there, and we observe the melting of this fresh water from the ices, that could really disrupt that circulation system. And what would the consequences be for that? Long term.
Well, yeah, the water's sinking because it's salty, but you've got this huge fresh ice cube sitting on top of Greenland, and it's melting. And so, a lot of work has been done to try and understand what's the consequence of that meltwater when it gets into the ocean. And the short answer is that it is probably going to slow down this overturning circulation, the one that has the deep water sinking really deep in the far North Atlantic and then spreading around. And that's important because that circulation actually carries heat into the North Atlantic and then releases it into the atmosphere. So the ocean is this conveyor belt for taking heat out of away from the equator and spitting it out in the atmosphere farther north. And so that keeps the mid latitudes relatively mild. So winters in northern Europe, especially in places like Iceland and so forth, might become more severe if the overturning circulation shuts down. But of course, global warming is happening too, and it's probably going to overshadow a lot of any cooling signal that happens in the North Atlantic.
Let's talk a bit about your methodology, because you were just there, as you said, for 4 weeks. I've seen some of the videos of you in the aircraft. Could you tell us about, what exactly you do when you're taking these probes and dropping them into the ocean? Tell us about the probes and how you go about making these measurements.
Well, yeah. So after our first year of driving the ship around, we started the real work of OMG, which was measuring the oceans and measuring the ice. And so every year for 5 years, we have two different surveys that we do. And the one that I just came back from was the survey of the ocean. And to do this survey of the ocean, you know, we just talked about how the warm water is down deep. So you can't just measure the surface of the ocean and think you know what's going on. You actually have to measure the temperature of the water hundreds of meters below the surface. And to do that, what we do is we take this this instrument. It's called an AXCTD, Airborne Expendable Conductivity Temperature and Depth Sensor. I know it's a mouthful. But we it's in this gray cylinder, which is about 3 feet tall and about 5 inches in diameter, and we push it out of the plane. We literally drop it through a hole in the bottom of the plane. There's a small parachute, and it lands in the ocean. And when it hits the ocean, it splits into two parts. One part stays at the surface. It inflates a little bladder that floats. And that transmits radio signals back to the plane. And that's how we collect the data. And then the other part actually falls. It drops off of the floating part. It's like a little torpedo. And it's connected by a tiny little wire. And so this little torpedo-like thing drops through the ocean, collecting measurements of temperature and saltiness as it goes. And all that gets radioed back to the plane in real time.
You're listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Schlom. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll get right back to our conversation with NASA oceanographer Josh Willis. He just got back from Greenland as the principal investigator for OMG, Oceans Melting Greenland. Stay with us. And we're back. And thanks for listening. Let's return to our interview with NASA climate scientist and oceanographer Josh Willis. You mentioned conductivity. So I'm just to kind of educate our listeners out there is when water is like just pure distilled water, it does not conduct electricity, right?
That's right. You know, we think of water as a conductor, you know, don't
drop your hairdryer into the bathtub.
Exactly, right, exactly. But in fact, really pure water is a lousy conductor. It doesn't conduct electricity at all. The reason most of the water we come in contact with is a conductor is because it has salts and other things dissolved in it. And it's those that really carry the electrical signals. And what that means is that saltier water is a better conductor. So for oceanographers for decades have been using these measurements of how much resistance is in the water or conductivity, they're really the same thing, in order to figure out how salty it is. And so it's our standard way of measuring saltiness in the ocean is to actually measure the conductivity.
So that's how you measure how salty the salinity of the water is by how it conducts electricity.
Exactly, exactly. And it's another thing that's very difficult to measure remotely. There are instruments at NASA that measure the salinity right at the surface from far away. But if you want to know the saltiness down deep where that warm water is, you have to stick an instrument down in the water and measure it directly.
Well, when you drop these probes, how long do they operate for? Is it just a matter of minutes or hours? How long do they work for?
It's just about 10 minutes. The whole thing comes alive almost as soon as it hits the water. It does a couple of quick diagnostics, and then it drops the probe and starts transmitting the data. And it finishes in about 10 minutes. After 10 minutes, the floating part actually sinks itself, and the whole thing falls down to the seafloor, where it decomposes over time and is covered by sediments.
Oh, so they kind of recycle back into the ocean bottom.
Exactly, exactly.
What kind of aircraft are you in, and how, you know, what, tell me about the crew complement. How many people are with you on one of these missions, including the pilots?
Well, this year we just had five crew members. Two of us doing the science and dropping the probes, one airplane mechanic, and two pilots. So it was a small crew this year, which was nice. It made it easy to move around and be flexible. And we flew on, this was really fun, we flew on a DC-3 airplane, which, if you remember, it's kind of like the Indiana Jones plane. Its tail sits down low on the ground. So when it's sitting on the ground, if you climb in, the floor is actually sloping up as you go towards the cockpit. So it was a really fun plane to fly in, because whenever we would land, you know, you'd land just like a normal airplane and you'd feel the two front wheels touch the ground. And then you'd tilt backwards as the rear wheel came down. So it was almost like you were going to take off again. It was really funny.
Wow. Yeah, that's the old World War II Korean War era workhorse, the DC-3.
Absolutely. In fact, our aircraft was built in, I believe, 1943. And was, I think, part of the invasion in Normandy.
Wow. Oh, wow. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Well, and, you know, when we talk about you dropping these probes, it really is kind of like pilot to bombardier, and you've got a tube and you just drop these things, right?
Yeah, that's right. You know, I should say that the plane has been, even though it was built in the 40s, it was rebuilt just this last year by a company called Basler. They put all new wings, new engines, and the FAA officially recognized it as a zero-hour aircraft, never flown before. And so we had sort of the maiden voyage, apart from some test flights. So it was really like a brand new old school plane. Yeah, it's just like you say, you know, me or sometimes the aircraft mechanic would stand in the back of the plane with the probe. And there's a cylinder that goes down through the bottom of the plane, a tube. And we would just wait for the pilots to call out exactly when we were over the spot that we were supposed to drop it. And they'd say 3, 2, 1, drop. And we'd let go of the probe. And oftentimes, actually, the pilots would bank the plane just after we dropped it, and you could actually see the parachute open and watch it fall all the way down to the ocean. And that turned out to be important sometimes, because we needed to see whether we dropped it on an iceberg or a chunk of sea ice and didn't expect to hear back from it.
Oh, yeah. What? Yeah, that would be important. But it also sounds like an awful lot of fun. I mean, I can just imagine, like, you know, little kids being up there dropping stuff out of the airplane. That sounds like a blast.
It really was exciting, and it's a great honor and a lot of fun to be able to go out there and do this kind of work. And you know, we're seeing really interesting things from the data too. We're really finding out, you know, each time we make a new discovery, that the ocean's really playing a very important role in how the ice is melting in Greenland.
And do you also have to worry about, you know, fishing boats and whales and things like that?
Absolutely. You know, NASA, at NASA, safety is really number one, and it's our top priority, even above doing the science. And so every time we drop a probe from the plane, we have to be able to see clearly the water that we're dropping into, and make sure there's no, obviously no boats and no people. But also no wildlife. You know, we don't want to drop these on narwhal or whales or anything else. And so we clear the area by flying where we can see and make really certain that we're not dropping on top of anything.
Wow. What are some of the big takeaways, like, from your last trip? I'm sure you've got lots of data to crunch before you write your papers and draw your conclusions. But what are some of the big picture takeaways about what's going on there?
Well, I think what this picture is really starting to emerge that the water on the shelves can linger for years. When we first started taking data in Greenland in the oceans, we collected a bunch of data along the west coast of Greenland. And then in 2016, a bunch of cold water came through in one of the big currents that runs up the west coast of Greenland, and it kind of parked up on the shelf. And so we saw this cold signal arrive on the shelf and kind of spread north up the west coast. Now, this doesn't mean global warming's over. You know, the ocean has all kinds of natural warm and cold cycles, and water's always flowing around. But what was interesting is that this one seems to have stuck around for a couple years, so it's still there. And what we're really interested in is seeing how long this water can sit in, especially in these deep pockets, these kind of carved out regions in the shelf, because that kind of sets the rate at which the oceans can affect the ice. You know, if a big blob of warm water were to wash up on the shelf and sit there for 5 years, then it could have a major impact on the glaciers. But if it gets washed away and replaced by, you know, newer water once every 2 weeks, then, you know, maybe the glaciers don't feel it as much. So what we're really finding is that these signals, these kind of blobs of warm and sometimes cold water really do linger on the shelf, and they really are having a long-term impact on the glaciers and how fast they're retreating.
Is what you're observing there indicating that sea level rise perhaps might be, you know, worse than we thought it might be before you started doing this investigation?
Absolutely. The fact that the water can have such a big impact on the ice really is only just beginning to be appreciated by the science community. There's a few examples that have been known for a while where this happens, but the idea that it can really affect the whole ice sheet is very new. And so if the water is important, and remember, the oceans are over 90% of global warming is happening in the oceans, then the ice sheets are really in trouble because they can melt much more quickly than we've predicted in the past.
Wow. And that leads me to a different tact I'd like to take with you. Recently, just this last month, the IPCC, the UN panel for investigating climate change, came out with a pretty dramatic report indicating that, you know, if we don't keep ourselves to that goal of staying at a 1.5 degree Celsius warming, you know, average warming of the globe over the in pre-industrial industrial times, that the things are going to be pretty dire. Could you give us your take on that? What did you think of that story?
Well, yeah. I mean, it used to be the 2 degree limit. And the reason scientists started talking about a 1.5 degree limit was because 2 degrees was so bad. So it's, it's alarming, but not surprising. We've known that this much global warming is going to have a major impact, and we're just now beginning to taste what that's going to be like. We're just getting a taste of it so far. The fact is that we're going to have a lot more global warming. We're going to have a lot more sea level rise. Storms are going to get more intense. All of this stuff is going to happen. And, the question is, how bad are we going to let it get? And I think what this report makes a compelling case that we shouldn't let it get worse than a degree and a half of warming at the surface.
And yet at the same time, you know, we have some governments, including our own around the world, that are, you know, kind of an active state of denial about climate change.
Well, I mean, it's, you know, whether the government is talking about it or not, you can look out your window and see it. I mean, sea levels are rising around the planet. Temperature records are broken. You know, highs are broken at twice the rate of lows. There's, you know, evidence of it all around. And, you know, it's beginning to be fast enough that just in a single generation, people can go, yeah, I remember how the climate was different when I was young. And that wasn't really true even 20 years ago. You know, the changes were small enough and that, you know, maybe if you asked your grandpa, he would be able to tell. But now, even in a single lifetime, you know, we're seeing changes and they're happening more and more quickly. So it's there. We have to deal with it. The question is just how bad do we want to let it get?
When you have conversations like with your friends, you're just the people your own age that you socialize with, what's their reaction when you tell them this stuff that you're working on? Do they just not want to hear it, or, you know, do they get alarmed? What kind of reaction do you get from, like I said, your peer group?
I think they get bummed out, you know. It's one of the reasons I started trying to do comedy, because it's a little depressing. You know, at best, it's depressing. You know, at worst, it's really alarming. But I think, you know, our challenge is to not let that paralyze us. Our challenge is to, you know, go, okay, this stinks. Let's tell a joke about it, laugh a little, and then figure out what we can do. And, you know, I think my peer group is coming to that realization, but I think the younger generation, you know, the people just graduating from college and even down to high school and so forth, you know, young people get it. I mean, it's obvious that it's happening, and they're already asking, what are the questions, you know, what can we do? They're already asking the tough questions, you know, how do we fix this? And so I think it's incumbent upon us to start answering them.
Well, and the hopeful thing is that we, you know, we were smart enough to invent an industrial economy that depends on fossil fuels to power our lives and warm our homes and drive our cars and all this great stuff, this great technology that we depend on that makes our lives better. You know, since we're smart enough to do that, we're probably smart enough to solve this problem if we put our minds to it.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, a lot of the solutions are already known. You know, it just takes a certain amount of will and a certain amount of agreement socially. And, you know, it takes movement in the government too. I mean, you can't fix global warming by yourself, much as we would all like to. I think, you know, it's going to require our government and other governments coming to the table and starting to figure out ways to, you know, help the technologies that will save us and steer away from the technologies that are driving us into the ground.
Well, while you were away in Greenland, we had several weather events. We've had, you know, terrible fire season here in the western United States, especially here in Northern California, driven by multi-year drought and poor forest practices and things like that. But, you know, there is that little layering on the top of climate change. But there's also been these hurricanes. We had Florence that was just, you know, dropped a deluge of water in the eastern seaboard states there. And then Michael just came on so swiftly and was so powerful. I was wondering if you could comment on the recent hurricane season.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, all of this stuff is a little worse because of global warming. Sea levels are a foot higher than they were before global warming started. You know, storm surge from these things can be 15 feet or something like that. So adding an extra foot on that may not sound like a lot, but it actually translates to significant area. And the other problem is that some of the natural barriers, like the wetlands and things, can't grow as fast as sea level's rising now. And so some of the protections being lost for flooding. That's an important factor. Of course, both of these storms would have been devastating without it. But then there's also the fact that the atmosphere can hold more water. There's more rain to be dropped onto the land. And finally, the engine for hurricanes is heat in the ocean, and there's more heat in the ocean. And all these things right now are kind of at the 10% level, maybe 20% level. But if you add them all together, well, now it's starting to be significant. So we're getting to the point where we can't ignore the impact of global warming on these things. They'd still be devastating tragedies without global warming, but it's definitely making it worse. And the thing is that this is, you know, like I said earlier, it's just a taste. It's just the beginning. It's all going to get bigger as we go.
It's like a layer of very nasty frosting on top of a bitter cake.
Exactly.
You mentioned that you like to use comedy to communicate your understanding of what's going on with the Earth's oceans and atmosphere. And we really do need to think of it as the ocean atmosphere system. It's not just the atmosphere. It's both things working together that control our climate. Could you give me some examples of, like, how do you use that when you're communicating to audiences?
Well, sometimes I do a little character named Climate Elvis.
I've heard of him.
Yes. he sings a little song called The Climate Rock.
Yeah, and we'll put a link in our podcast, definitely, so that people can check that out, because that was a lot of fun. And tell us briefly about that. What was your experience like making that video?
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. obviously, you can tell I love doing it. It was a blast to make that video. And it's kind of a culmination of what I've been trying to do for a long time, which is tell jokes about global warming. And, I started off with simple jokes about, like the polar bears losing their habitat because the ice is melting. But, you know, I'm not an expert, but polar bears will probably survive because they can always just move south and eat the Canadians instead.
Rim shot.
Right. Boom. Exactly. Over time, I realized that I needed to hone a few other skills, and I started taking comedy classes and performing. And this song was actually an idea that I had for a contest, the Flame Challenge, that was held by the Alda Center for a few years. They asked scientists to make a video. And, you know, a lot of my science colleagues, when they go to make a video, they tend to prop up a camera and talk into it, sort of like we do to each other when we go to science meetings, and like a teacher would talk to their students. And I really wanted to do something different than that. So I decided to bring this character of Climate Elvis to life, and I wrote a song for him called The Climate Rock. That explains what climate is in simple terms, and then says it's warming.
Climate is the generally prevailing weather conditions, including temperature, precipitation, humidity, wind, cloudiness, as a function of time throughout the year, composited over many years.
What?
Let me try something a little different.
Sunday on Sunday, high 73. Monday, rain was pouring down on me. Tuesday was cold, I almost froze my toes. But what's it gonna be next week? Who knows? That's weather. Oh, that's the weather you got. But you take it, lose your weather, and your averages together, and you're doing the climate rock.
Josh, it was just, it's a pleasure as always talking to you. And when do you next go back to Greenland?
Ooh, well, I'm definitely going to go back in in August because we'll be doing the survey again next year. But I may also go back in February and visit some colleagues who work in Greenland and study study the climate there. They're also having a climate day, and so I may also go appear as Climate Elvis in Greenland.
We'll look forward to that. Thank you so much, Josh Willis, oceanographer and climate science expert from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. Thanks so much, Josh.
Thank you, Dave.
Thanks to our guest, Josh Willis, from NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. Josh is the principal investigator for the Oceans Melting Greenland mission. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll check in with our nature and environmental correspondent, Cheryl Hosler, also known as the roving naturalist from YouTube, for a report about the importance of mentoring in environmental science and education. Stay with us.
Our climate is the average of the weather you see. The critters and plants all know where to be. A cactus can't live in the tropical rain. And polar bears don't dig Bahrain. That's climate.
Wait a minute. So, are you saying that plants and animals know about climate too?
Well, that's right, little Miss Jane Goodall. Every living thing on Earth is adapted to the very specific climate that it lives in.
We're back. Let's check in now with our environmental science correspondent, Cheryl Hosler, as she tells us about the importance of mentoring.
Where do environmentally minded adults come from? Assuming you're listening to this program because you're interested in science, how did you get that way? What combination of factors molded me into a person who's devoting their life to nature? Like many other environmental professionals I know, my story starts with my family. For as long as I can remember, my mom and dad were all about getting us outside. We had a swing set and a vegetable garden in the backyard, and my younger sister and I were encouraged to spend ample time on both. My mom cultivated lovely flower gardens and showed us how to pull weeds when we saw them. I have fond memories of rattling down single-track dirt roads with my dad in his red pickup truck so that we could go to our favorite fishing spot on the edge of a shallow river. He taught me how to use a kick net to harvest helgramites to use as bait, and he helped me fillet my first sunfish. My dad brought me along to pick-your-own orchards and taught me how to spot the best-looking cherries and apples. He took me to the county fair, where I could get up close and personal with horses, cows, and sheep. A few years later, my training as a naturalist intensified. My grandpa brought me along on my first Audubon Society Christmas bird count, and I was hooked. We would go hiking almost every weekend, and while we were out on the trail, he would quiz me on the identification of birds, trees, and other wildlife. We explored the stone ruins of farmhouses reclaimed by the forest, examined how human and natural disturbances changed the landscape, and investigated the complicated relationships between living things. This isn't to say you can't be an environmentalist without similar childhood experiences. I know plenty of people who became environmental professionals without this sort of family background. But does mentoring like what I received have an impact on our attitudes and behaviors once we're adults? Almost certainly. In the 70s and 80s, researchers developed what were known as deficit models, assuming that increasing knowledge of environmental issues would lead directly to increased rates of pro-environmental behaviors. But the connections between knowledge and action are much weaker than those researchers thought, and there's almost no relationship between the two without adequate mentoring and fostering of those connections. Whether or not a person feels responsibility to or for the environment and chooses to act on those feelings is affected by a huge number of factors, many of which are difficult for researchers to identify and credit with levels of importance. However, there are a few things we do know. I have always advocated for experiential learning when I teach environmental education. It's more fun to learn about the effects of pollution on stream macroinvertebrates through a game than through a lecture, and getting up and running around helps kids burn off steam so they're better able to focus on information. It's even better to learn about those effects by actually collecting the macroinvertebrates in ice cube trays to examine how pollution changes the community that we see. It comes as no surprise, then, to find that direct experiences with nature and environmental issues have been shown to have a much stronger impact on our knowledge, attitudes, and behaviors than indirect experiences can. While watching a video about deforestation can provide someone with an abstract idea and opinion of the environmental impact, walking through a deforested area can inspire emotional reactions that may manifest as future pro-environmental behaviors. We should also remember that we, as humans, like to feel like we belong to social groups, especially those of our families, friends, and cultures. When pro-environmental behaviors are normalized in a social group, like my family, where every single home has a clothesline to help conserve energy, they're much more likely to be adopted and perpetuated by new members of the group. So if the adults in a family or community are mentors or role models through demonstrating pro-environmental behaviors, the children in that community are likely to grow up to do the same. So how can we, as adults who want to be stewards of nature, inspire the next generation to do the same? How can we provide formative experiences similar to those that shaped our views of the world? The easiest way is actually just to keep doing what we do, behavior-wise. As with most things, leading by example seems to work in environmentalism, too. If you, as an aspiring environmental mentor, are able to model positive behaviors for the younger people around you, you're probably already making an impact. This is especially true if you demonstrate a strong connection between your environmental knowledge and your pro-environmental behaviors. And while showing is good, doing is better. Bring young people along with you when you go hiking or fishing or picking up litter. My grandpa used to bring me along as he inspected cabins on state forest land, or years later as he inspected conservation land easements. Is it any wonder I grew up to be a conservation scientist with all of this free job training early on? Mentoring by doing should also provide easily actionable solutions to the environmental problems you help your mentees become aware of. While the destruction of South American forests or the looming specter of global climate change may feel like problems too big for any one teen or child to confront, what can they do, with your help, to make some sort of positive difference for the environment? In the case of environmental mentoring, knowledge and behaviors are power. What does an effective mentoring experience look like? My grandpa and I are hiking in the Pennsylvania forests, in one of our favorite spots not far from his house. Beneath the trees, almost the entire forest floor has been consumed by Japanese barberry, an invasive plant that was originally brought to North America to serve as an ornamental in people's gardens, but which has since gotten out of hand. Barberry, like many other non-native plants, is a strong competitor in environments where it has no natural predators or diseases. Additionally, barberry sports incredibly sharp thorns that protect it from grazing animals, and it bears small red berries that attract grouse, turkey, and other birds that subsequently spread its seeds through acres of woodland. Barberry has effectively taken over this forest, in part due to its amazing ability to outcompete native plant species, and partially thanks to the deer. When the deer population in an area gets too high, the animals will overbrowse tree saplings, wildflowers, and most other native vegetation, leaving the forest floor completely bare and ready for an invasive like barberry to colonize. That's exactly what happened in this area of woodland. But my grandpa takes me over to an odd fenced structure, probably 20 yards on a side and 10 or more feet tall. This fence, he tells me, is to keep out deer. It has to be very tall because they can jump over anything shorter than that. We go through a gate in one of the sides of the fenced off area and enter a completely different woodland. In here, there are shrubs and wildflowers, including some species that I've never seen before on any of our hikes. In here, protected from the deer, the native plants are able to outcompete the invaders. In here, I can experience a snapshot of an ecosystem unaffected by human impacts on nature, like invasive exotic species or artificially inflated herbivore populations. But even if you don't have the resources to provide that sort of elaborate mentoring experience, there are still plenty of ways to employ the tools I've given you here. Bringing children to a nature center or zoo is great, and engaging them in conversations that compare their own life experiences to the knowledge and examples on display is even better. Talking about similar experiences, like favorite foods or favorite toys, can help foster feelings of empathy for wildlife in children. Comparing animal homes to their own homes can remind children of the importance of protecting habitats so animals have a place to live. And seeing members of an endangered species at a zoo, now an all too easy to accomplish experience, can help kids begin to understand the fragile nature of life once it's been affected by human development. If these conversations become the norm in your family or social group, they can have a lifelong impact on the attitudes and behaviors of the young people in your life. If you'd like to aim to have a wider impact, there are certainly ways to be a broad-scale mentor as well. You could volunteer at a zoo or nature center, teaching programs and engaging perhaps hundreds of children each year with the environment, natural processes, and conservation behaviors. Or you could become an advocate for the implementation of infrastructure, like city recycling programs and public transportation, that enable more people to engage in pro-environmental behaviors. Plus, becoming an outspoken advocate for the environment is another way to lead by example. And of course, you could always throw money at the problem. More research can and should be done on the most effective ways to inspire more people to environmental consciousness, and conservation and mentoring programs need funding to run, but I think I still prefer the personal, active approach to environmental mentoring. So how did I get to where I am at the beginning of my career as an environmental scientist? It was a really long walk through the woods with my grandpa, almost a lifetime's worth of hiking up and down hills and in and out of forests. I am grateful to him and to all of the other mentors that together provided me with the examples of pro-environmental behaviors that have sculpted who I am. Think back on your own mentors. Who were they? Why was spending time with them so valuable to you? What about those experiences sticks in your mind 10, 20, or 40 years later? Those are the things that you can pay forward to the next generation of environmental stewards, ready to work for the betterment of our planet.
Thanks to our guests, Cheryl Hosler, the roving naturalist on YouTube, and Josh Willis, oceanographer and climate scientist from NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. Check out his team's research, Oceans Melting Greenland, on jpl.nasa.gov. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio in beautiful Northern California. Check out this and past episodes at mynspr.org or subscribe to us, Blue Dot, on NPR Podcasts. We're distributed via the Public Radio Exchange, better known as PRX. Our theme music is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by Mr. Sky Schofield. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.